I'm Don Marsh. Welcome to this special holiday edition of St. Louis on the Air. We're going to reintroduce you to our online St. Louis history lesson, St. Louis History in Black and White. It's been a fixture on our website detailing St. Louis historical events as described in St. Louis on the Air interviews with experts and people who lived those events. We have now added to the series a comprehensive look at Ferguson since the death of Michael Brown. Today, a taste of how civil rights in St. Louis was impacted by two major civil rights demonstrations, and a look at the life of entertainer Josephine Baker, who left this country because she was black. First, the city's most important civil rights demonstration in the 60s, held at Jefferson Bank in 1963. The decade of the 1960s was a turbulent one in American history. It was marked by the assassination of John and Robert Kennedy and Dr. Martin Luther King. There was widespread opposition to the Vietnam War and considerable social unrest as a result of black America's demands for equal rights. These demands frequently spread to violent confrontation in the streets, especially after the King assassination. Unlike some cities, racial unrest in St. Louis never turned violent, but it simmered until surfacing in the summer of 1963. Days after the historic March on Washington and Dr. King's famous I Have a Dream speech, the march was in part a demand by black America for more jobs for African Americans. Jobs were on the minds of blacks in St. Louis, too. Former Congressman William Clay, then a St. Louis alderman, was instrumental in launching a peaceful protest in St. Louis. The incident is detailed in Clay's book, The Jefferson Bank Confrontation, The Struggle for Civil Rights in St. Louis. In a conversation less than a month after President Obama's inauguration, Bill Clay, with his son, Congressman Lacey Clay, who succeeded his father in Congress, reflected on how such incidents helped pave the way for Barack Obama's election.
Oh, I think that that was very key and very critical, not just for the 60s, but it goes all the way back for a couple of centuries. You see, black people never did fully accept slavery. They objected to it from the very beginning, even though some of our historians will tell you that that we were happy, that at least we were fully employed doing slavery, and so that everything was okay. But you had people who from the very beginning objected to it, and those are the people who are the heroes of this country because they helped to change the attitude that said that you could mistreat, you could deny a person's self-importance, that his selfhood, his personhood, and that he would be perfectly all right, and the morals of the country would be all right. So we all, people who engaged in the struggle for equality, must have had the same feeling that I had on election night. It was very emotional. I still get emotional. And it was one that said, we helped to make this possible.
Congressman Lacey Clay.
It speaks volumes about this community and this country and how we have progressed and gone down that path together as a nation, learning and listening and moving forward. I am a product of the civil rights movement, having been a small child growing up watching my dad through the civil rights fight here in St. Louis. So it's in my DNA.
Blacks in St. Louis felt they were shut out, excluded, and tired of it.
We lived on what I can refer to, and I don't refer to it in the book, as a sub-economy. Most of our income was from illegal, illicit activity that we shared with white people who made as much profit off of the illegality as we did. We had to pay police officers on the beat to let us violate the law. We had to pay judges when we got caught or prosecutors to nolly-prost the case or not to give you the extreme sentence. This went across the board because there were no jobs. You couldn't work for the utility companies. You weren't meter readers. You weren't clerks. Black women couldn't be secretaries anywhere. It was total exclusion. So when I say that, when I ask the question after explaining all of that, was it time to throw tea over the side of the boat? You answer.
The black community felt the white establishment had a stranglehold on it.
Well, it was what I refer to as economic genocide. Black people were excluded from every major industry in this town. You couldn't be a salesperson in the four downtown department stores. You couldn't drive the buses from the breweries, from the dairies, from the bread companies. You couldn't work in the construction unions. You couldn't sell automobiles. All of this in 1963. So you have to understand where we were. You had two publishing companies of religious periodicals. They had two blacks working for them out of 900 employees, and they were both menial positions. This was true across the board, including city employees and state employees and federal employees in this whole region. So it was total exclusion of black people in the employment field.
Activists like Norman Say, Ivory Perry, Percy Green, and Clay were working with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. The decision was made to demand more jobs. There were any number of likely targets, but the Jefferson Bank put itself at the head of the line.
They picked themselves. Bob Curtis, who was chairman of CORE, wrote a letter to a number of institutions suggesting to them in very strong terms that you hire X number of blacks within a certain period of time. The attorney for the Jefferson Bank wrote back and said that this was against the law, that we were insisting that they show preferential treatment to blacks over qualified whites in employment, and that he didn't know four blacks in the whole city who were qualified to work in that bank. So theoretically, they picked themselves. It was a small organization. We couldn't go after everybody that was discriminating, but we decided that they wanted it.
And they got it. Seven at the time, Lacey Clay remembers his father being among a handful of demonstrators arrested.
I remember that fateful day in August of 1963 when demonstrators were first proceeded around the bank demonstrating, and then we violated the court order and went inside and sat and did a sit-in in the lobby. So I remember that, and then I remember that evening the police coming around the house and eventually my father turning himself in. And then for several years after that, us being involved in the court proceedings and going down to the jailhouse to visit him, first in the old city jail, and then to the newer workhouse at that time.
The elder Clay remembers as well.
Well, it was really a holding place to take convicted individuals who were convicted of murder and rape and all of the other bank robbery, all of the other crimes to jail. It was just while they were either awaiting trial or had been convicted and were waiting to be transferred. So it wasn't a nice place. It was a very, very dangerous place.
Those jailed had formidable allies like Margaret Bush Wilson, whose civil rights work went back to the post-war era and helped produce a Supreme Court ruling against restrictive covenants in the Shelley versus Kramer case. The demonstrations drove the white establishment closer together, but the black community at large was mad as hell and not going to take it anymore.
Oh, I think that was the general attitude of the community. And we're thankful that we had people who give leadership like the ones you mentioned. Margaret Bush Wilson was there as our attorney, along with 17 other black lawyers who pro bono provided us with legal representation. You had Norman Say and 18 others, along 17 others, along with myself, who challenged this system, and we were sentenced to some pretty heavy terms, up to a year in jail for contempt of court. The most strenuous and the longest sentences in the history of this state for contempt. And we were fined thousands of dollars. But the community rallied. More than 500 people got arrested at that bank in protest to what was going on. And it wasn't just the bank that we were protesting. We were protesting employment across the board.
But there was a second community, the white community.
They sided with the power structure, the religious community, the media, all of the power forces in this town came together, the police department, the elected officials, to make an example of the people who were demonstrating at the Jefferson Bank.
It fueled numerous demonstrations. They went on for weeks, and the number of arrests mounted.
In my case, I was given 270 days. Most of us served 59 days before we were let out on, wasn't bail. The Supreme Court said you had to let them out. We had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get out. And then the local judge set the bail, the bond, at $10,000 for bail. Can you imagine the people that were going out on bond? And bond is supposed to assure that you either come back to court or that you're no threat to the community. Now, of the original people, of the original nine that were arrested, three were elected officials. Three were school teachers. One was a minister. All of us owned property. Who in the heck was more likely to come back to court? And who? And they could find us easily after we got out, because we all appeared back on the picket line. One time, while we were out on bond, I was arrested again for blocking a van that was going to arrest some additional people. So I spent another day or two in jail then.
Clay insists it was not an accidental alliance united against him and the others. He had always been outspoken and still accuses the white elite of a conspiracy in denouncing the demonstration and the demonstrators.
No, it was a conspiracy between Civic Progress, the downtown business people, of course, the mayor of the city of St. Louis, the president of the Board of Aldermen, the chief of police, the head of the police commission, and the governor, plus people in the educational communities and other civic leaders. They had all kinds of meetings to make sure that they sang in unison, in one voice, that we were guilty, number one, even before the trial started, that we were bad for the city of St. Louis, who was making tremendous progress around the country in terms of integrating everything in this town. And so the conspiracy started at the top with the governor, with the Post-Dispatch, with the Globe Democrat, with the mayor. The mayor kept pushing his 10-point proposal for resolution of the problem. Well, the mayor and the city was part of the problem. The mayor didn't enforce. We had the strongest civil rights bill on employment of any city in the country, but no enforcement. And so he was part of the problem. Yes, it was a conspiracy.
Clay also believes the judge in the case, Michael Scott, fed off of it.
I think what happened was, see, the Post and the Globe, they went overboard in trying to say that we were outlaws, that we belonged in jail, that we violated every law on the books. And they praised him just equally on the other side, and they talked about him upholding the dignity of the court, of the judicial system. And I think he started to believe that. And so when the decision was made by the Supreme Court that they wouldn't hear our case, then he started talking that crazy stuff about the dignity of the courts. And we tried to figure out what court was he talking about. It certainly wasn't his court, where we were denied due process during the whole trial.
There were scores of arrests and fines and difficult litigation. Clay himself was jailed twice, but things were happening. The Supreme Court's refusal to become involved slowed down the dynamic, and more civil rights activism across America was giving establishment St. Louis pause and time to reassess.
While we were out of jail for like a 3-year period, the business community decided that we didn't want the same thing to happen to our city that was happening around the country when there were riots and burnings and all. And they decided that they were going to accommodate what was only fair. The downtown stores started hiring salespeople. The automobile companies hired salespeople. The banks hired 800 black people in positions they had never been in before. And this was happening across the board. We still had problems with the utility companies, and that's why even after the Jefferson Bank demonstrations, Avery Perry and Percy Green continued the attack on the telephone company and the gas companies, because they never did completely come in. But it was a sea change in terms of employment for black people. So, you know, and that's why when we went back to jail the second time, it was a ridiculous thing. Even the Chamber of Commerce and the bankers were opposed to this crazy judge sending us back to jail.
Things began to change. According to the Clays, the Jefferson Bank confrontation, though it was almost 4 years before all the litigation was over, may have spared the city more violent problems down the road. The Clays believe that the demonstration and the result released a pressure valve that was bursting in other places. They say confrontation in 1963 prevented conflagration in later years. Lacey Clay.
I remember the weekend that Dr. King was shot in April of 1968, and instead of St. Louis burning to the ground, the St. Louis leadership, including my dad, organized a peaceful demonstration from the Arch grounds to Forest Park, I believe. And that kind of quelled any of the hostilities that may have been bubbling under the surface in the community. I just think St. Louis has approached it in a different way, like the Jefferson Bank demonstration. Now, whether it would have been better for St. Louis to burn down, I'm not sure. Having lived through it, I think it was better that it didn't burn.
The Jefferson Bank demonstration did for this town what the other cities that did burn, a lot of them, were still demanding. We got the jobs and we got the positions. But then what happened when Lacey refers to the night of the Dr. King's death, we called the black leadership together in this town, including the militants, the people who had the potential of stirring up the kind of animosity. And the ministers were there. The total community was there. We met all night until about 4 o'clock in the morning when we woke Mayor Cervantes up, who came to that meeting and gave his assurances that not only was he going to do things, he had already done things after he got elected mayor. He changed the whole tone. But he gave assurances that, and he was on the phone calling people who really, the decision makers in this town, getting their commitments. And that's where the idea came for the march rather than the burn. And then the churches joined into that. And the march left the arch, which is to Forest Park, which is probably a 6-mile walk, but it was thousands of people that joined.
Congressman William Clay served a total of 105 days in jail for his role in the Jefferson Bank demonstration. He served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 32 years and is proud of his accomplishments there.
Number one, I helped to structure the pension bill that now preserves their pensions even when companies go out of business. ERISA was part of the bills that I provided insight and instruction on. And then for 20 years, I led all of the debate in the House and managed the bills on the floor for workers of this country. I passed 295 pieces of legislation that became law, and most of them dealt with elevating the standard of living for people who work every day for a living. Minimum wage bills for 15 or 20 years, they were all my bills. Plant notification. If a plant closes now without giving you 60 days notification, they have to pay you 60 days pay. COBRA, when you lose your job, but you don't have to lose your insurance. You can take that insurance with you, but you have to pay. You have to pay the premium, of course. But before, you couldn't even take the insurance with you, your group insurance. Those are the kinds of things. Hatch Act reform for federal employees, they can now get involved in political activity as long as it doesn't interfere with their job. But you can go right down the line. Most of the labor legislation, labor rights that workers have in this country, I was responsible for it because I was the key person for the Labor Committee for almost 20 years. I was their spokesperson, and I was the one that managed the bills on the floor of Congress for them.
Significant fair housing legislation sponsored by Alderman Clay was before the Board of Aldermen while he was in jail. A longtime civil rights pioneer, unknown outside of the black community, was David M. Grant in St. Louis, the board's legislative director. He conspired with a member of the board to ensure that Clay's legislation passed, even without Clay, to lobby for it.
Dave Grant and Joe Clark, who was also an alderman, they concocted the scheme where they were going to advise the other members of the Democratic caucus what the reality was. And so Dave said, you know, it's a tie vote, but Clay will be out of jail in a couple of weeks, and he will vote to win the to make sure that the fair housing bill passes. Then Joe Clark chimes in and says, you know, Clay is the biggest claim artist in town. The rest of us will get no credit. He will take all of the credit. So they convinced two people to change to keep me from getting the credit. And, of course, I was happy.
Congressman Clay faces re-election against two opponents in the November 8th election. Coming up, a much more violent racial confrontation, the East St. Louis riots of 1917. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Compared to what happened in East St. Louis in 1917, the Jefferson Bank demonstration was a walk in the park. There were many dynamics at work in East St. Louis a century ago. Few were surprised when the lid blew off, and blow off it did.
About 500,000 blacks moved north between 1910 and 1920. Most of them came during World War I, and 4,000 or 5,000 of them came to East St. Louis. In some cases, they took jobs that had been held by white people. In some cases, they were used by companies as strike breakers. So there was a great deal of antagonism towards the blacks by many, many whites in East St. Louis and indeed in St. Louis in those days.
Aluminum and steel factories, nearby stockyards, and meatpacking operations fanned the antagonism.
Jobs were at stake. And the industrialists who brought in the blacks as strikebreakers and continued to send labor gangs down to the South to bring blacks in long past the time when there were any jobs for them, were cynically exploiting this antagonism between the blacks and the whites. The blacks and the whites were both victims to some extent. But to whites, particularly downtown where the blacks tended to live, it seemed as if they were under invasion. Mm-hmm. They weren't used to being around so many black people.
Blacks then did not necessarily feel exploited. Historians would later argue that, in a sense, they were still slaves. They did not recognize the hold white employers held over them, as detailed in a book titled Slavery by Another Name.
And it argues that slavery really didn't end in the United States until the 1940s and the 1950s, when school integration and civil rights legislation came through, that blacks, particularly in the South, were in a condition of virtual slavery right up until almost the middle of the century. And certainly East St. Louis was very Southern.
The city's population at the time was 75,000. 10 to 12,000 were black. There was corruption at every level, fed in large part by poverty and the fact the big companies that kept racial tension high operated from out of town. East St. Louis was just the labor pool and not much else.
Almost 50% of the city's income came from saloon licenses. It's just astonishing. By comparison, at the same time, about 4 to 4.5% of the income of the city of St. Louis itself came from saloon licenses. So East St. Louis got 10 times as much of its income as St. Louis from saloon licenses. So they couldn't close them down. They depended upon these, and they were the lowest sorts of dives. Criminals flocked to East St. Louis from all over the country. It had a reputation as a wide open town. And so when the antagonism towards the blacks increased among the people you had, sort of the troops of the riot, in effect, were these people that spent their days in bars and their evenings mugging people.
Nonetheless, blacks who were prevented from joining white labor unions were happy to take white union jobs. Adding to the potentially explosive atmosphere was the city's well-deserved reputation as a wide-open town.
It was a very corrupt city. New York, the detective came from New York and walked to visit a St. Louis policeman, walked down Collinsville Avenue one day, the main street, saw three different people, all of them wanted for crimes in New York, and they were all separate. They were not with each other. And these were all white people, I should tell you.
East St. Louis had a police force, but it was more a part of the problem than a solution.
The police department was very low, was not paid well. There were justice of the peace courts, and the justices of the peace were not paid at all. They made their money from fines. So to have this continual influx of petty criminals coming through your courts contributed, and bribing police to get out, to be let out of jail, contributed to the, in effect, the salaries of the police and the justice of the peace.
Blacks comprised about 10% of that force.
There were about 70 policemen, all of them underpaid. There were six black policemen. The black policemen were all plainclothesmen. And my assumption is that the idea was that the white citizenry would be intimidated, offended, or something if a uniformed black policeman showed up to direct traffic or something. I don't know that for sure, but it seems to make sense. The police were as corrupt as the rest of the city. In fact, a reporter for the St. Louis Globe-Democrat who covered the riots testified later that, in fact, the six black detectives were, on the whole, considerably more honest than the 63 white policemen.
The perfect storm was in place. Corruption was rampant. The black and white populations were poor, with many unemployed. Those who were working were being exploited by out-of-town corporations. The animosity against blacks was at a high level. In January and May of 1917, there were incidents in which blacks were beaten and shot by whites. Miraculously, no one was killed. After these incidents, blacks had warned that they would retaliate against any further violence. After this incident, they did, tragically.
On July the 1st, a black Model T Ford, or several black Model T Fords, drove through a black neighborhood of East St. Louis, and men in the car or cars fired into homes along the street. Finally, a group of black men got guns. Guns were very prevalent in those
plentiful,
days.
Plentiful, I'm sure.
Guns were plentiful in those days. And they were ready to repel the invaders the next time they came through. Instead, an unmarked police car with two plainclothes policemen came through. And on a dark street, the blacks shot, and the two policemen were fatally wounded. Tragically, these two policemen in the little riot I mentioned in May, had stopped a white mob from burning down a row of black houses. They were not involved in the earlier attacks, although there may have been some policemen involved in the earlier attacks. But at any rate, in thinking they were repelling invaders, these armed blacks killed two white policemen. And the riot started the next morning.
There was no stopping it now.
The police car that was riddled with bullets and the seats were covered with blood was parked in front of the police station the next morning, which was right next to City Hall. And a white mob gathered around the car. And another group of white men met at a place called the Labor Temple on Collinsville Avenue, right near downtown East St. Louis. And the anger of the two groups kept growing and growing and growing. And finally, the men in the Labor Temple stormed down the stairs, and they met the men who had been gathering across from the police station, and they went to the intersection of Collinsville and Broadway, which was the main intersection of East St. Louis in those days, and they stopped streetcars and began pulling blacks out of the streetcars and killing them. First beating them, then shooting them, then killing them. And as the day went along, it got worse and worse and worse and more intense. At least two black men were hung from lampposts in the middle of downtown St. Louis. Blacks were thrown off of the bridges into the Mississippi River. A child was thrown into a burning building and never seen again. It got, W.E.B. Du Bois compared it to the horror that the Germans had perpetrated against the Belgians in World War I.
It was out of control. Even the National Guard was drawn into the bloodletting.
The National Guard was very reluctant to do anything to stop the riot until finally a tough, no-nonsense commander came in late in the day. And in fact, there were stories of soldiers from the National Guard actually shooting at blacks as they fled from white mobs.
By the thousands, the blacks who could fled the city itself.
The survivors did not want to talk about it. It was such a horrible thing. One example is the city of St. Louis alderman, Terry Kennedy, his grandmother crossed over with his father, who was 7 years old, from East St. Louis to St. Louis on a raft that they built out of driftwood at the riverbank. And he said his grandmother died a few months later, they thought from smoke inhalation from the fires. And his father, who later became an alderman himself, Alderman Sam Kennedy, was very reluctant to talk about it. It was just so horrible.
Long before she became an international star, a young Josephine Baker watched from St. Louis.
She was 11 years old, lived in the Chestnut Valley down near Union Station, like thousands of other St. Louisans. She ran to the riverfront to watch East St. Louis burn down and watch thousands of black citizens come across the two main bridges, the Eads Bridge and what was called the Free Bridge. She compared it to the apocalypse. And 2 years later, Josephine Baker left St. Louis, and pretty soon she left the United States, where she went to Paris. And she said many years later, in a speech at Kiel Auditorium in the 1950s, that one of the main reasons she had left the United States was the sight of East St. Louis burning and of blacks being killed.
When the smoke cleared, the official death toll was placed at 39 blacks dead, 9 whites. But it's certain many more blacks actually lost their lives.
W.E.B. Du Bois of the NAACP, the famous civil rights leader, came to town, interviewed hundreds of people, and he came to the conclusion that 100 or perhaps 200 had died. The coroner's jury in St. Clair County decided that at least 100 had died. There were stories of, for instance, a man's widow collecting life insurance from an insurance company, and his death was not recorded. The death of the child who was thrown into the building, the child was never identified.
Of course, there were investigations, but history suggests they were something less than thorough. When it came time to send people to jail, more blacks than whites were convicted.
There was a series of investigations. No National Guardsman was ever charged with anything, although the military did investigate. There were congressional investigations, and a lot of my material comes from the transcripts of those congressional investigations. And there were trials. In the end, 9 whites and 12 blacks were sent to prison. None of the policemen who had been involved in encouraging the rioters. Some of them were charged, but none of them was ever convicted of anything. And one of the senators who was here for the congressional – or congressman who was here for the congressional investigation said, it doesn't appear you could convict a white man of anything that happened on July 2nd, 1917 in East St. Louis. As for the black population, about 7,000 blacks, which would be roughly half the black population or more, fled the city. Thousands of them came to St. Louis where they were taken care of and fairly well, it appears. And the black population of East St. Louis in 1920 was about the same percentage that it had been in 1910. So thousands of these people left and never came back.
The incident produced long-lasting scars, even in some who were born long after the riot.
Miles Davis said in his autobiography that the race riot in East St. Louis had had a negative – he thought it had a negative effect on his attitude towards white people that lasted all of his life. Well, Miles Davis was born in 1926, 9 years after the riot. And I thought, my goodness, if it was that powerful in the oral tradition of East St. Louis, then it must be worth looking into. And indeed it was.
The East St. Louis riot was big news all over the country. There are few pictures, however, because news photographers say their cameras were routinely smashed as they tried to cover the mayhem. In New York, a large group of blacks staged a silent parade in protest against the East St. Louis carnage. Some marked that parade as one of the very first of the civil rights movement, which was yet to fully unfold. It took decades to do so. When we come back, Josephine Baker, the East St. Louis riot is one of the reasons she turned away from her community and her country. That's next. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. The East St. Louis riots had an impact on many, if not most, African Americans in the region. One of them was Josephine Baker. She was a major star, but her country was not kind to her because of her color. She experienced racism most of her life and was certainly affected by those East St. Louis riots, just one of the many events that told her how difficult life could be for black Americans. Baker historian Benetta Jules Rossette, author of Two Loves, Josephine Baker and Art and Life, says Baker's show business career started early, not on the stage, but on the streets of St. Louis.
She was only 13, 14 years old at the beginning. So her years in St. Louis were limited. She had a very tough life there where she would try to play for nickels and dance for nickels in the street. And then she entered that vaudeville circuit as a teenager and eventually ended up in Philadelphia and New York with Noble Sissle's productions of Chocolate Dandies and other very well-known performances. While in St. Louis, she also worked at a nightclub and as a waitress. She did a number of things trying to pass her age off as 16 rather than 13 and so forth.
Mary Strauss owns the historic Fox Theater in St. Louis.
One of my favorite remarks is that she said at one point she learned to dance to keep herself warm.
Wow.
Which says so much about her childhood.
Opportunities for black performers were limited in the 20s, just as they were for years to come. Josephine had limited routes to follow.
The limited opportunities for African-American performers at any level in the 1920s in the United States. So what was open to her, which she broke into very innovatively, was the vaudeville circuit, where she performed in blackface as a minstrel and a comic performer. We might compare her to a sort of a blackface Carol Burnett. This is the kind of thing she did.
race was an issue she had to confront every day. Mary Strauss.
I think the whole thing about race and the color of her skin, it depended where she was. Sometimes she was too dark, sometimes she was too light. And so there is a song that she sings, J'étais blanc, if I was white. And, I mean, that just sort of wrenches you when you hear it, because that was something her whole life, I think, that she struggled with.
It was a life that had more dead ends than opportunities. Jim Crow was alive and well. Stop signs were everywhere for black performers. But two wars showed black entertainers there were alternatives to the U.S.
There were actually hundreds of African Americans who we think about the migration from the South to the North after Reconstruction and at the turn of the century, and especially before and after World War II. But there was a considerable migration after World War I when many African Americans had served in the Army.
It was an awakening for black entertainers and artists. Opportunities were out there and over there. Josephine Baker took advantage of those opportunities. She, as did so many other accomplished blacks, went to France. It was transformative for her.
Once she went to France, she became increasingly articulated with France. And I must say, during my turn of the conversation, that 1937 she became a French citizen through marriage, and for the rest of her life, we need to look at her from the French perspective, but not forget her roots in St. Louis and in the United States.
But for the African Americans who went abroad, there was lots they wanted to forget.
She was just so excited to be there because people weren't telling her that she couldn't eat in this restaurant and she couldn't, you know, go in this shop. And, you know, they had freedom on the street and freedom to have interracial relationships. And it was just a completely different atmosphere. And they were so giddy to be there and so excited because they were being treated finally like human beings and in some ways even idolized.
The Sexy Baker was quickly a hit, largely because of the costuming, some of which is iconic to this day. The famed banana skirt, which covered little below the waist, was a sensation. In 1936, after years abroad, home shores and the Ziegfeld Follies beckoned, but they were less than friendly shores. Olivia Laz Gonzalez was the curator of a Josephine Baker exhibit at the Sheldon Art Gallery.
She was panned for her voice. She has a very beautiful, very high, bird-like singing voice, which is extremely charming. But I think for American audiences, it just wasn't to their taste. And so she was criticized for her singing voice and
for really being too Parisian.
Right. And also for being too Parisian. I think some of the African Americans felt that she'd let them down by leaving the United States. They felt that she should have stayed for the fight. So she was criticized from that point. She had trouble getting into hotels. You know, she was a huge star in Europe by this time. And just imagine coming back as a huge star and then being turned away from hotels. So it was a difficult time for her. And when she went back, I think it was quite a long time before she set foot back in the States.
Home now was France, but it soon became wartime France. Josephine Baker was true to her adopted homeland and served it well. She won the nation's Legion of Honor, an extraordinary award, and France's highest honor.
She was actually a counter-espionage agent and a lieutenant in the French Air Force.
Right.
She could actually fly a plane. And the resistance,
right,
often known as the Maquis, was a little bit different. She worked for Charles de Gaulle's Free France as a counter-espionage agent.
In the 50s, she was singing a song unsung at home and in many parts of the world, a song of inclusion and on a very personal level. She turned her eyes toward the world's children and adoption.
12 children from around the world because she felt that every race could live in peace and harmony together. And so it's known as her Rainbow Tribe.
And basically she would synopsize her own life and her own struggles and then develop a plan and a program for a new world of peace and interracial harmony.
But Josephine Baker was troubled that the rainbow did not extend to her native country in the post-war years. Living a life of racial tolerance in France, she was outspoken about the lack of it on visits to her native land. Mary Strauss.
Well, she was very active in civil rights, and she insisted when she came to the United States that she would perform only in non-segregated audiences. And the very important stand here in 52, isn't it, Olivia, when she came to Kiel and made a speech. And also in 1952, the NAACP wanted to honor her in Harlem, and they declared one day Josephine Baker Day, and 100,000 people came out to honor her.
But she still faced humiliation when she came back to America. She went to New York's popular celebrity hangout, the Stork Club, in the early 50s, ordered dinner, waited 90 minutes, only to be told when she complained that blacks could stay for drinks but would not be served dinner. She complained to the NAACP and to columnist Walter Winchell. She asked him to write about the incident. He did, giving her story, though, an anti-American slant, as he sided with the establishment's owner, Sherman Billingsley. He even took Baker's complaints to J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, which compiled a huge file on Baker. It took years to untangle the Billingsley-Winchell-Hoover web.
She was exonerated by the FBI. Eventually, they said that she hadn't done anything. But Walter Winchell accused her of numerous things that were what he called anti-American. And the unfortunate part about this incident is that it led to the revocation of her U.S. visa, because by now she was a French citizen and needed a visa to perform in the United States. And it was revoked until Robert Kennedy in the 1960s removed that revocation so she could come to the March on Washington and rectified everything. And then eventually, as I said, the files were also opened and a public apology was made long after her death.
She died in 1975. Josephine Baker's life was a struggle, ups and downs, success, disappointment. It all began in the most humble of circumstances in St. Louis. The end was something she worked all her life to earn.
She was viewed as a venerable and a fantastic performer. And, and many people today remember her from the performances that she performed at Carnegie Hall then in 1974. She was accepted by the end of her life, I would say.
Like to many black Americans, it took an entire lifetime to be recognized and accepted for their humanity and for their accomplishment. As I mentioned earlier, St. Louis History in Black and White has expanded to include our extensive St. Louis on the Air programming on the Ferguson story. You'll hear about major events from key players, and it's our hope that this series can be useful to educators. It should also be useful to corporations to help employees and those they hope to recruit to better understand this community. The expanded series is up and running right now. You can find it at stlpublicradio.org. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with humorist Dave Barry about his new book, Defending His Home State of Florida. We'll also meet the owner of the St. Louis Surge women's professional basketball team. It recently won a national championship. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.